Follow the Sound. I am your host, Brian Kroc. This week, we have another This Week in Music History. And to help me out with this process of delivering you the glorious information of music from days past, I have with me my friend, Jacob Grum.
Good evening!
And of course, I have my other friend, Greg Harvey.
Was gibt's?
That was lovely, actually. That was pretty good enunciation there.
That means what's up in German.
Yes, I didn't know that, though. I don't speak German other than World War II terminology.
I know what's up in Tagalog.
Anunda!
I know things like Minenfeld.
Or
and
in Spanish, ¿qué pasa?
This is the fastest Schnell. Show has ever gone off the rails.
It just went straight downhill right off the bat.
Jeez, sorry.
Oh, my goodness. Sorry. Greg's like, you know, fluent in German here, apparently, and I'm just floundering around with my barely capable of speaking English. So there you go. Before we move on, I would just like to say, if you like the show, hopefully you're still listening, but if you like the show, go ahead and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, any place that you have found our podcast, or you can subscribe directly to the RSS feed if you know how to do that. But it would really help us out because then you get an automatic download whenever we produce new content, and we do try to produce a couple of things every week just for our beautiful, beautiful fans, if they do exist. But also, if you want to help support the show, besides subscribing or possibly giving us a rating on iTunes, you can help us out by going to followthesoundpodcast.com and on the right-hand side, see the Amazon banner. Click on the banner. It takes you to Amazon. You can do all your normal shopping. It doesn't cost you anything extra, and we get a little bit of money back just for the referral. Very simple. You can go to our website, or you can go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. Now, let's get on to music history this week. We got April 17th through April 21st, and we're kicking it off with April 17th in 1953. What you got?
I got Harry Belafonte's debut on the big screen, the silver screen, in a film called Bright Road. Never heard of it before. I looked it up, and the plot is insane. Harry Belafonte is the principal of a school.
Yes.
There's a problem child and a female teacher, and she takes him under her wing, and then, like, the kid's best friend dies, and he does poorly in school, but somehow she overhears him, and he's absorbing the information and actually teaching other students, so she starts just, like, giving him a passing grade, even though he's not finishing any of his tests. And then,
interesting.
Yeah, and then the end of the film is an entire swarm of bees comes into the class, and everyone freaks out, including the teacher, and they start swatting him. And then this kid, like, calmly walks over and picks up the queen bee, and the swarm follows him outside. And that's the end of the film. And I feel like
Harry Belafonte was in this.
Yes, he was the principal of school.
As in, like, Sonora's.
Yeah, shake, 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 Sonora.
Which actually popped up on the radio last week.
There's a hole in the bucket, dear Liza. Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, he didn't write that song, but he did cover it.
I'm pretty sure he didn't write Shake Sonora.
I just like Harry Belafonte.
Yeah. You know?
And also, I love just seeing him in, like, every picture from the civil rights movement.
They're like, he was crazy. We have a black actor.
Yeah.
Let's stick him in everything. Okay.
Here we go. I want to see a gritty remake of Bright Road where the kid dies at the end.
Ooh.
From
dark.
Being stung by bees. Yeah.
Wow.
Wait, they already did that in My Girl. Sorry,
say,
spoilers.
That's the entire plot to My Girl.
Well, it'd be better with Harry Belafonte in it. He should reprise his role as a principal.
What if they
Macaulay Culkin dying in the end due to those bee stings?
Macaulay Culkin was stung by Harry Belafonte.
If they redid it with Macaulay right now, like 34-year-old still in high school,
he probably should be stung to death by bees. Great, if he...
But moving on to 1982, we've got Benny.
No, I got 1971 here.
Oh, well, let's hear it.
All right. I got, in 1971, all four Beatles solo singles were on the UK charts, with Paul McCartney had Another Day, John Lennon, Power to the People, George Harrison with My Sweet Lord, and Ringo Starr with It Don't Come Easy.
I'm sorry, but My Sweet
Apparently,
Lord.
Apparently, it does.
My Sweet Lord, best of the four right there.
Oh, yeah. Easy.
For sure.
Easy. I mean, which is really funny. I would say that it's My Sweet Lord, It Don't Come Easy, Paul McCartney's Another Day, and then Power to the People by John Lennon. That's how I would rank them.
What group would you put Ringo above Paul and
Just from those four songs.
Yeah, well, yeah.
That's the only time I would actually do
that's
that.
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
But, yeah, no, and I've always just, I've liked It Don't Come Easy. It's such a simple song, yet it's just a good quality
I like
song.
That one, too.
But, yeah, My Sweet Lord is just a brilliant song in and of itself, so... But now, moving on to 1982.
I don't know why I'm going into this with such excitement, because these are two back-to-back really sad stories.
Go for it, Jake.
But Benny Ashburn, manager of the Commodores, dies of a heart attack. Shortly after that, Lionel Richie goes on his very well-written, very well-covered, and...
what?
Solo career.
Solo career.
I don't know. I like Lionel Richie. That's what I was trying to say.
Oh,
okay.
I've seen Lionel Richie actually,
yeah,
in concert. He played at Life Is Beautiful like 2 years ago, and it was a phenomenal experience. Actually,
did he do All Night Long?
Of course he did.
Oh, of course, yeah.
But the greatest thing about him is that, mind you, like Life Is Beautiful has a lot of like younger acts, right? I think Kanye West was playing the next night. You know, it's like, and then they had like Lionel Richie, like the one old guy act in the group. The year after that, they had Stevie Wonder. So. They tried to like stick the one like act from yesteryear. So Lionel Richie gets up there, and I swear to God, this man commands a stage like nobody else. Like Kanye West could have only dreamt of commanding an audience like Lionel Richie did. And that's because everybody knew every single song. Like, even if they didn't know the song, they still had heard the song somewhere before, and they're like, oh my goodness, I didn't know he did that song. And so that's what I loved about Lionel Richie, is that he was a fascinating person to watch do this giant festival with, you know, like 80,000 people in the crowd.
It's fantastic to know that he still puts on shows that are awesome.
Yes.
Just in general. And I love it when festivals do that, too, where they throw on a few of the good, like, really big name... Like you said, bands from yesteryear, and they put them in there. I love that. Even like when Vans Warped Tour does that, where they bring in a few of the old bands that probably played Vans Warped Tour like 10 or 15 years ago, and then they're doing like 2017.
Yeah.
I love that.
I dig it. I like when they do the old school stuff with Warped Tour. That's always fun.
Does Lionel Richie do any Commodore stuff?
He's done a few Commodores. He did like a Commodores medley in the middle of his set.
Okay.
So, which was pretty good. And then, he did a couple of other ones after that. And then I think he closed out with All Night Long. Mm-hmm. That or at least
I know the answer to this, but why has Lionel Richie not done a Super Bowl?
I don't know. He should.
He really should. I mean, I know the answer is because the performers paid to do the Super Bowl.
I was going to say, they don't get paid to do the Super Bowl.
No, they pay to do it.
No, but I did see a list today of like, who would you like to see play the Super Bowl? And it was all like, Taylor Swift and Justin Bieber and blah, blah, blah.
Dude, I want to see the old R&B guys do one before they're gone. Like, I want to see Stevie Wonder, and I want to see Lionel Richie.
Actually, I did see the Rolling Stones poll that they put out, though, and leading at the front of that poll was 21 Pilots. So that I actually wouldn't mind, so seeing them perform.
There are a couple of people from the Ikettes still around, aren't there?
I guess so.
I think they're all right. Anyway.
Moving on. What else you got from 1982?
Here we go. Yes. Greg, you familiar with Christopher Cross?
Yeah.
You know the song Hey Laura?
Sure.
Okay. Well, Laura Carter, the lady that inspired the song... on this day in 1982, was shot and killed by a stray bullet in a diner in Columbus, Ohio, after she was playing a lacrosse game.
Wow.
Yes. And I also read that the bullet came from, quote, gang violence. And Columbus, Ohio was the last place I think of as, like, the depth of gang violence. So that's one stray fucking bullet.
Yeah. I mean, well, as you well know, considering you are a gun enthusiast, I mean, you fire a gun at any sort of actual arc.
Yeah.
I mean, and it has potential to kill somebody. So,
wow. Like, well, Columbus, Ohio is a major city.
Yes.
Yeah.
Still is. I mean,
surprisingly, 21 Pilots comes from there.
I was gonna say there's gang violence in Springfield, Illinois, and that town is like 20 times smaller than Columbus.
Yeah, I guess.
Do they do it around Lincoln's house though? Because that would just be even better.
Kinda, yeah.
That would be hilarious.
A little bit. Lincoln's home is in a decent area.
It seemed like it was pretty decent when I was there.
I mean, it's nice. It's touristy and it's federal property.
Yes,
but the neighborhood around it.
How do we sidetrack?
What are those holes up there on top of Lincoln's house? Oh, those are bullet holes from the time the The one shoulder overalls gang fought the Carhartt gang right over here.
Right.
Anyway,
we had the First Street Boys up against the Ninth Street Hooligans, and
anyway, Christopher Cross went to college with her, and he was his girlfriend was Laura Carter was her best friend.
Oh wow,
man,
so that's crazy.
Yeah, and
that's
there's a really wonderful dedication on her headstone that I believe Christopher Cross paid for, but I can't confirm that because I only found one source for it. But it's possible that he actually paid for a headstone after Hey Laura hit the radio. And he made some money from it. So
wow.
Nice.
Well, moving on to 1991, Nirvana appeared at the OK Hotel in Seattle, where they played a new song, Smells Like Teen Spirit. That they played it live for the first time ever. And other local bands such as Mudhoney, Tad, Mother Love Bone, and Soundgarden all appeared at the club. Of course, that club is no longer in existence, and it is now a residential property.
Oh, that sucks.
That happens to a lot of great clubs, but nobody seems to care. Like, they go through these phases of, like, you know, all these amazing artists that sort of come through an area, and then it, like, all dies down. The only place that I know of that doesn't really happen is, like, New York and L.A.,
yeah.
You know, I mean, but even in New York, CBGB's was bought and sold to somebody else. And then out in L.A., I know it's happened a bunch of ones with, like, you know, the Viper Room and, you know, a bunch of those other clubs that are there on the Sunset Strip.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can.
The Whiskey a Go-Go. That's the other one I was thinking of.
I can testify to a lot of those music venues are places where, you know, in the moment, they're kind of almost seen as a nuisance.
Yeah.
In a sense, I know. I mean, just going back to Springfield again, but it's because I can super relate, is that, you know, one of the local music clubs that all of the decent bands, I'm doing my little air quotes here, but decent bands that come out of Springfield, you know, they all play the Black Sheep Cafe. Black Sheep Cafe is considered like the venue right now in Springfield.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, if you go there, a lot of local residents would be like, tear that place down. Get it. It's an eyesore. Get it out of my face. It's, you know, it's BS and this and that. And then maybe 20 years from now, people will be like, man, you remember the Black Sheep? It used to be right here and this and that. Yeah. But, you know, right now it's like, oh, all these kids, you know, loitering outside and, you know, it's an eyesore and blah, blah, blah. So I'm sure it's a similar situation, you know?
I was fascinated recently that this is a non-music thing really on the side. Alton Brown came through town, and Alton Brown being the famous, like, TV chef guy. I've met him a couple times. Really cool dude. Super nerd, actually. So, but he posted a picture of when he was at the Fox Theater in his dressing room, and apparently a bunch of bands and stuff who had played there have signed one of the, like, the doors that goes in there. And it was him standing there with kind of his head peeking out around the door with, like, all of these really super famous names, and he goes, I am not worthy of my dressing room. He's like, thanks, St. Louis, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, yeah, there we go.
Awesome.
So we do have that with the Fox Theater. That's, like, you know, a big deal, obviously, but a lot of the clubs that, like, Jake and I remember growing up don't exist anymore.
Well, the Creepy Crawl,
The Creepy Crawl was right there, like, literally a block from where we are right now, and it's gone.
Yeah, what is it now?
It's like it was a pet hospital, like, for a little bit, and now next to it is, like, a Chinese restaurant, so.
Well, I used to go to the second incarnation of Creepy Crawl.
Oh, yeah?
Which is, you know, closer to SLU down there.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, is it now the KDHX building? Or is it, like,
probably,
right next door to that?
I don't know, but the KDHX, like, lounge is, you know, they've got their big thing that they do there. But, I mean, Creepy Crawl, like, was a must for any St. Louis band. The High Point was another one. Mississippi Nights was, like, if you were doing super good.
Yeah.
And then, like, the Galaxy even was a major hotspot.
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, I guess the premier venue now would be the Pageant.
The Pageant or Del Mar Hall.
Yeah. And, so, and I mean, 15 years ago was Mississippi Nights was...
But I have heard that they are, this year, they've started a new festival down at the Landing called Mississippi Nights.
Oh, cool.
Music festival.
Cool.
So
cool.
I looked at the band names, and I was like, I don't know who any of these people are. Yeah. But I am kind of interested to go. So
now that you mentioned the Galaxy, I'm going to have to bring this up. But I still have the waiting room, the band's room, waiting room, right?
The green room.
The green room, yeah.
That was a bathroom.
Yes.
At the Galaxy, that still sneaks its way into my dreams. I very specifically remember the graffiti on the wall, and the room's full of dicks. There were just so many dicks drawn in. You don't look at me like that, Brian.
What? I'm smiling because I'm remembering.
Sounds like a music venue.
Yeah, I DM'd a game at a convention not too long ago, and that became a detail. Like, the characters walked into a nightclub, and I'm like, what's in here? It's the bathroom of the galaxy. So I very specifically described how poorly drawn the dick on the couch was, and there's a much better dick on the wall, and yeah.
Nice.
Welcome to the dick show, ladies and gentlemen.
On that note, let's move on to something very somber. Mm. In 1998, Linda McCartney died after a long battle with cancer. She married Paul McCartney in 1969, and basically they spent every night together, like, for their entire relationship, which is impressive. She was working as a photographer at the time, and then she became a member of Wings. She was a huge animal rights activist, and even created her own brand of vegetarian food.
And she passes away, and now he's married to a woman half his age. And
well, he married the one lady, and then, like, she took a bunch of his money. So, it is what it is. Well, Paul McCartney. Linda, he was lost without her. He should have just not remarried. He should have just had, you know, a relationship, but he should have never remarried.
Well, it always just gets really weird after your significant other passes away as a celebrity. Yeah. And then you start kind of going off and being like, I'm single again, and I'm famous and rich. And then you start getting into just some weird stuff.
Yeah, really that's weird stuff. That
well,
is
he was
true.
Getting into weird stuff when he was married with her. I mean, like, he did that video with Michael Jackson. Different kind of weird, but still weird.
Yeah, I was gonna say, but not weird. Well, I mean, not weird like he's a bachelor.
Well, I mean, he did a ton of collaborations.
Yeah,
I mean, he did Ebony and Ivory with Stevie Wonder, and then, like, even now he did the one collaboration with Kanye and Rihanna.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which is actually, like, not terrible.
No, it's a pretty good song. Yeah. He actually performed it when he was here in St. Louis, and it was really good.
So what would you say is Linda McCartney's most notable achievement?
Well, I mean, I remember the fact that she was an animal rights activist, and I mean, I'm sometimes at odds with the animal rights
going
activist
down
group,
with Paul's weed. That's her greatest achievement.
Oh, that was pretty good.
Taking the fall. Yeah.
Don't worry, babe.
Officer, that's mine.
You're my meal ticket. I got your back, sir. That is mine.
Don't worry. He can bail. He can afford to bail me out. Yeah, I can't afford to bail him out.
Yeah. All right, let's close out the 17th with 2009. Jake, what you got?
2009, this is a good note. Jim Morrissey walks off of a stage at Coachella because he smelled barbecue.
Go from one animal rights activist to another.
I don't think he's an animal rights activist.
Well,
I think
he's a hardcore
kind of a
vegan.
Bag.
So he
smelled barbecue and it disgusted him.
Yeah, and he said something on stage like, I smell burning flesh and it makes me sick. And then played half a song and then just left the stage.
Hmm.
See, I actually know of there's some very famous, like, weird people, you know, who do musician stuff, and on, like, their not the writer, but I think it's whatever it is, but they've got, like, stipulations for when they play someplace. And I remember one I won't name names, but all of the meat that was cooked had to be cooked somewhere else and then shipped in, and there couldn't be any popcorn served. Because he hated the smell of popcorn.
Fair enough, yeah. Hmm.
Well, if you're asking me to come perform at your venue.
The weirdest writer I've ever seen, and you can find it online, is Glenn Danzig. Glenn Danzig had a really weird one.
Okay.
He wanted it was a bar in Texas to hire between 7 and 15 white women, taller than 5'5", but shorter than 5'10", dressed roughly in the same attire to attend the show and be in the front row. Like, he wanted them to hire models and then dress them like punk rockers.
Wow.
To be in the front row.
Interesting.
And as far as I know, they weren't shooting a video.
That's super lame.
Yeah,
I know one other group, they specifically requested puppies. okay. to be in their dressing room.
Hmm.
They wanted like six puppies.
Oh, that's going on our that's going on our podcast rider. So they had puppies over here.
They had to like go out and find some puppies.
No, I think
they were all like a you know they weren't like from a store or something. It was like they went out and found like some rescue puppies and stuff, and
they just went out and started knocking on doors.
And then like I think to the band's credit, they actually did like post photos of the dogs. And then tried to get them adopted. So it wasn't just that they were like, I want to frolic with puppies for a few minutes before I go out and play. It was something completely different. But let's move on to, what, did you have something?
No, I was just, well, since you're letting me, I was just going to say, one band mentioned how, I just heard an interview the other day, that they said that the rider asked for all this alcohol that they honestly don't really want or drink, but they feel so guilty, quote, guilty, to ask for it and then not drink it, that they purposefully make sure they drink all of it anyways. But they didn't like actually want like 12 cases of beer, but they feel really bad that they had to get them and then not drink them. So they made it a point to still like pound all this alcohol before they left, just so that like they wouldn't feel guilty for asking for it in the first place.
Nice, nice.
Ooh, that would be sloppy.
That would be pretty bad.
Well, like you don't even want it. Why would you get it in the first place?
Yeah. I've seen some pretty funny riders in my day. And like I even saw one today, actually, because they released the one for 21 Pilots. I'm bringing them up again. They released their rider, and it was like, you know, like two avocados ready to eat, but not too fresh. Or it's like... It's like, and they wanted a bottle of local hot sauce and like a couple, like five different types of cereal and then like three different kinds of milk. It's like it was just really funny, goofy things that they did. But let's move on to April 18th. What do we got for 1943?
And two pairs of pants.
1943. Very well-known drummer Clyde Stubblefield is born.
Yes.
Yes.
Clyde Stubblefield, famous drummer.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you're into James Brown and if you are into sampling,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I don't know if you've ever listened to like Public Enemy or.
He did not do the Amen Break.
No.
I know that for a fact.
No, he's not the Amen Break.
But
no, the Amen Break. Excuse me.
Yeah, because, well, the name of the song was Amen Brother,
yes.
And so they call it the Amen Break.
No, but he did do, in the studio, he did Cold Sweat, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, and I Got a Feeling, which were all huge in the early 90s and late 80s hip-hop.
Yes, yes. Very much a sampled artist, which is kind of sad because I highly doubt that he got much money from any of that sampling, just like the drummer from the Amen Break, who ended up getting like a little bit of money later on.
Right. Who else, ended up getting forgotten.
Yeah, which is ridiculous anyway. But moving on, 1971, what you got?
Oh, here we go. The movie FM opens.
The movie FM?
It? Yes.
I've never seen it, actually.
Never
what
seen
is it?
It's a movie about an FM radio station that
really?
Like, yeah, and they're like, you know, wild, crazy guys throwing parties, and then this corporate suit comes in, and he's like, honestly, I don't really like music. I don't know why we can't play commercials 24 hours a day. Wouldn't that be amazing? We'd all make so much money.
Nice music.
Right, we'd all make so much money, and then they're going to shut down the radio station because it's not losing money. It's not making enough money because that's what villains do, I guess. So then... they have a sit-in on the radio station, broadcast all night, Nario Speedwagon and Steely Dan come and play a show.
Well, like they lock themselves in the studio kind of thing.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, you know, and there's a crowd outside, and the police are all like, you know, on their megaphones, please come out, don't put the thing and get on the back. And they're like, woo, we're going to be here all night. The crowd's, yeah. Yeah.
Random side note. I got to say, my favorite two, like, radio movies... It's going to be kind of a goofy one. The first one being Airheads, because, yes, it does take place in a radio station.
Yeah, it does.
And it cracks me up every time I watch that movie. Second one, Pirate Radio, which came out just a little bit ago. It's about the British pirate radio ship out there, which just cracked me up.
I'm going to say WKRP in Cincinnati.
Love WKRP in Cincinnati,
yes.
And I love news radio as well. Because as Greg and I are both radio guys, like, is it just me or is it that everybody who gets into radio, especially ones who want to be DJs, want to be those guys? They want to be the guys that got to play whatever they wanted to. It, like, didn't care about, like, any kind of corporate thing coming down on them. It's like, and they got to be tastemakers, and they got to be awesome, and they were rock stars in their own right.
I love it. Because my career, I know, I've never been on a radio station that played, like, my personal favorite type of music.
Yeah.
But, you know, if I was in that situation, you know, even just like, even just a generic, like, rock station, that would still be really cool. Because I remember working with guys that were on the rock stations, and they would have those moments where they're like, oh, man, I absolutely love this song, so I am playing it next. And then they do, and people love it. And then I'd be on my station, and it's like, if you don't play a top 40 hit song, you are gone. It's like, oh.
Yeah. So I do enjoy radio movies and radio TV shows or stuff that is based around that, because that's really what, like, every radio guy wants to actually be like is to be able to do or say whatever they want and get away with it.
I
and
love
that.
Just,
that you should check out happen. FM. FM's my second favorite Cleavon Little movie.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
I will second say, favorite. Too, I love in Airheads where they show up with, like, a cassette. And they're even like a cassette. Like, we can't play it. Like, you put your demo on a cassette and you came to the radio
makes
station.
It sound like somebody standing my balls that kills all my hard notes.
Yeah, I've seen that a couple of times.
Oh, man.
What's your name? The Lone Rangers. Now, the Lone Gunman was from X-Files. Yeah, so it's the Lone Rangers. It's like, what? There's three of you. You're not exactly lone. Joe Mantegna. Oh, that's a good movie. I'm going to have to watch that one again now. All right, moving on to 1984. Michael Jackson undergoes surgery in Los Angeles Hospital to repair damage done after his hair caught fire during the filming of a Pepsi commercial.
Pepsi strikes again.
Dun, dun, dun.
It wouldn't have happened if you would have sponsored or if you would have, you know, promoted RC Cola. It would have been much more.
It was all sabotage from Coke. Everybody knows that.
The fire would have been greasier. I don't know.
Wait, RC Cola, they're a local, aren't they? Isn't that a local thing?
I have Royal Crown Cola. I have no idea.
I don't know if RC's local.
I know they've got a distribution center around here.
Yeah.
So, but that's neither here nor
there. You're thinking of Vest Soda. That was.
Well, I remember Vest was local, and
XL.
In Breeze, Illinois. I know they ski.
Yeah, that's XL Soda out of in Breeze.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I've been to Breeze. There's basically one street, and that's about it.
And a sign for the soda shop.
And a bunch of chicken farms. I'm not kidding.
That's where the soda comes from.
All chicken farms. Yeah. There's like a factory that makes soda, and then there's like one street where there's a bowling alley.
Have you tried their chicken noodle flavored soda?
No, I have not, but that sounds crazy.
Wouldn't it be?
Go to Rocket Fizz and pick that one up. So, let's see. In 1995, Oasis drummer Tony McCarroll was told by phone that he had been sacked from the group. McCarroll sued the Manchester group for millions in unpaid royalties, and in 1996, Oasis agreed to pay him a one-off sum of £550,000, or $935,000.
So he didn't even get a million.
Didn't get a million.
Mm.
Crazy.
He should have got a million.
But considering he didn't play on, like, really their biggest hits, you know, coming after that, like, What's the Story, Morning Glory, he didn't play on any of those.
Yeah.
So that's kind of one of the reasons why he didn't really get a lot of money after that.
Hmm.
But, and then closing out April 18th with 2006, a sale of clothes belonging to Sir Elton John raised more than $700,000 for the Singer's AIDS charity. And 10,000 pieces were sold during a 5-day sale in New York City at the specialty created shop, Elton's Closet, at New York's Rockefeller Center.
Hmm.
I've been to 30 Rock. That's a cool place.
I've seen the TV show.
That is a good TV show, too.
Is it just like the show?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they filmed, like, you know, there, so.
Mm-hmm.
It looks exactly like the outside of the building, because that's what they always showed, so.
Like Tracy Morgan, like, setting a fire in a garbage can or
that
something?
That would be really funny, actually. Moving on to April 19th, I believe, Jake, you got something for 1980.
Yes, we do. Blondie hits number one with Call Me.
Love it.
Song written for the film American Gigolo. I did not know that until yesterday.
Yeah, I didn't know that either.
Richard Gere film, he gets naked. Everybody knows this.
It is known.
It is known.
Well, this song is good. I love Blondie. I love that song, Call Me.
Track was also number one in the UK as well. Pretty big, pretty big hit for them. So well, Blondie had some massive hits back in the day.
I liked when they did The Tide Is High, and it kind of had that reggae feel to it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Fab Five, Freddie Coltozzi, everybody.
Oh, and Heart of Glass, of course. That's a good one, too.
Soon found out. Had a heart of glass.
Rapture is the one that kills me.
Yeah.
Literally?
Yeah, no, like, it's a very... It destroys my train of thought. I mean, puts my brain in stasis every time I see it, because it's just bizarre. Indescribable.
Moving on to 1980, 32-year-old English singer Brian Johnson joined the Australian group AC/DC, replacing Bon Scott, who had died after binge drinking in February of 1980. Johnson's first band was called the Gobi Desert Canoe Club. That sounds real rock and roll. He was also in a band called Fresh. From 1970, Johnson played with the cabaret club, the Jasper Hart Band, performing songs from the musical Hair. He and other members of the band went on to form Geordie.
You got to give me that band one more time, man.
Which one?
You know which.
The Gobi Desert Canoe Club?
Yes. Okay. All right.
Fresh?
It's funny.
The Jasper Hart
the
Band?
The Gobi Desert Canoe Club. Love it.
That's funny because you don't go canoeing in a desert.
No, you don't.
Mm.
It is what it is.
I think it's...
He's got to have one of the strangest like music arcs that I've ever seen. It's like, oh, let's eat the Gobi Desert Canoe Club. Fresh. The Jasper Hart Band. And it's like, you know, they do covers of Hair from the musical Hair. It's like, then forms the band Geordie and then joins AC/DC.
Well, and that's what I was going to get at, was just, it's funny that you got these big rock stars, especially a band like AC/DC, who, you know, maybe not the band themselves, but when you kind of imagine the fan base, you know, and there's a lot of the, AC/DC, rock and roll, you know, and it's like that guy was doing musical numbers. You know, before he got into this, it reminds me of, wasn't it Robert Plant?
Yeah.
When he did, he was the guitarist for Downtown.
Exactly.
You know, Downtown.
So, Jake, I know you're not like a huge AC/DC fan.
Man, I go back and forth.
You
on
like
AC/DC.
Him as much as the next guy, right?
I don't.
Well,
I don't.
No, he doesn't.
What?
I don't. But then there's times where I'll hear an AC/DC song that I haven't heard 1,000 times, like Jailbreak, like an old Bon Scott song. And I'm just like,
man, I don't know what I'm not, it is I always thought Bon Scott was the better singer than Brian Johnson.
I remember his name, I'll say that much.
Yes. Like, but Brian Johnson
should have changed his name to like Bon Tom or something.
Well, he did like Thunderstruck and, you know, a lot of the later hits, but Bon Scott had a lot of those like the early hits from AC/DC and like just really good vocalist as far as that's concerned. But Brian Johnson always kind of seemed pretty one note to me. Like everything was just like him singing at the top of his lungs and just through that gravelly voice, and like that was it. But
yeah,
I feel like AC/DC is the most successful opening band ever. I don't feel like they're a headliner.
I do have to say,
this sounds like the douchiest thing I've ever said. They don't feel like a headliner to me, but I don't know.
For me though, the reason why I think that like I go back and forth with liking them for being the guitar driven band that they are.
Yeah.
But then at the same time as me being a drummer, I can't stand it.
Well, yeah.
Cuz it's dot dot dot. That's every song.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's all it is.
I will say though, it's cool because the
with
drummer
with a little da 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 like thrown in there for some songs.
The drummer though, I love, he mounts two bass drums on either side of him.
Mm-hmm.
So he's got like the one he's playing with the foot pedal, but he's got two bass drums up on his sides, and every once in a while he'll reach out and he kind of does like the chicken wing. He puts both arms out and boom, boom.
Yeah, like for Thunderstruck.
Yeah.
And
Thunder. Honestly, that is cool. But yeah, besides that, he's very bland, basic, like Ringo Starr level drumming here.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, moving on to jumping ahead a bunch of decades here. 2010, a week after Catholic Church officials published an article in the Vatican's Les Avventures Romano newspaper that said they forgive John Lennon's remarks about the Beatles being bigger than Jesus. Ringo Starr, upon hearing this, rejected the forgiveness, The newspaper editor had written, "The Beatles said they were bigger than Jesus and put out mysterious messages that were possibly even satanic. But what would pop music be without the Beatles?" Ringo was unimpressed and replied, "Didn't the Vatican say we were satanic or possibly satanic, and they've still forgiven us? I think the Vatican, they've got more to talk about than the Beatles."
Yeah, that's true. I feel like they shouldn't have even acknowledged, like they shouldn't have said anything at all.
They shouldn't have.
I mean, that's one of those where it's like, oh, you think you're bigger than Jesus? I don't have to respond to that because you're not, you know, kind of attitude. I think the fact that they acknowledged it shows that they hit a chord, you know?
But here's the thing, and that is often misquoted with John Lennon, is that he was referencing specifically teenagers, stating that, like, amongst this demographic, we are more popular than Jesus.
Oh, yeah.
And it wasn't that we are bigger than Jesus.
It was
in reference to being popular. And so amongst teenagers, the Beatles were it.
Mm-hmm.
They were the new apostles. It's like, I mean, John, Paul, and George.
That's, so, I mean, you could say, yeah, because in comparison, you could say in 2017, you know, you could say that Kendrick Lamar or 21 Pilots is bigger than, you know, just name an older band that was great.
Yeah.
You know, you could say, oh, 21 Pilots is bigger than AC/DC.
Yeah.
Well, for the kids these days, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And John Lennon even referenced it, stating that, you know, he wasn't stating that, you know, they were, you know, like greater than or holier than or any of that kind of stuff, but that purely when it came to this group, they were more influential than the church or than the Bible, which was an absolutely true statement at the time.
Oh, Beatlemania. Come on. Where's Jesus mania?
Yeah, exactly.
It's out there somewhere.
That happens somewhere.
Yeah, it is out there, I'm sure.
And then I got another somber end for April 19th, 2012. Levon Helm died of throat cancer, age 71. The drummer, singer, and multi-instrumentalist Helm formed his own high school band, the Jungle Bush Beaters, at 17, and he later joined the Hawks, who became Bob Dylan's backing group, who then became known as The Band.
The Band. Mm-hmm.
Which is one of my all-time favorite groups. And he sang on, like, a bunch of the major hits from there. The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down, Up on Cripple Creek, Rag Mama Rag, and The Weight, off the first two albums of that band.
Yeah.
I mean, so they just kept going on after that. Really funny side story, though. My nephew... I go to church with my family. My family's all there. My nephew, who is 11, he's going to be 12 in just a couple of weeks, actually. He always rides with me in the car when we go out to eat somewhere afterwards. And so we get to have like fun little conversations on the 5-minute drive to whatever restaurant it happens to be. And we were talking about something, and I was talking about a band or whatever. And he goes, "Wouldn't it be funny if there was a band called The Band?" And I was like, "Oh, young one, there is. Let me play you some of their music." And so I played them like a clip of, you know, The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down and Jawbone, which is my favorite song on there, and King Harvest, and like a couple of other clips with it. And, you know, my nephew's not like huge into music, but at the same time, I hope that he kind of picked up on at least sort of my passion for that group. So
yeah,
it was a minor thing, but
he's going on being like Uncle Brian is so old. He listens to old music. And,
Well, I do listen to usually stuff that's older than what my brother listens to. So,
oh, you're one of the most eclectic people I've met.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, you know, as far as the depth of your, you know, interest in music, by far. I mean,
I try to listen to a lot.
You
so.
Know, at least a little bit of everybody.
Yeah, that's
you know?
True. I got that. Another thing too, Levon Helm was actually a pretty good actor too. He acted in a bunch of different movies. But the one I remember being surprised about was that he showed up in the movie Shooter.
Oh,
which cracked me up. I was like, "Is Levon Helm in a movie with Mark Wahlberg about them being snipers?"
Yeah.
All right, it works. But yeah, Levon Helm was actually a really cool dude. And I wish that I could have met him at least once, but That will never happen. So moving on to April 20th. What do we got? 1949.
Phil Spector, the world-renowned producer.
Infamous.
And murderer. Well, his father in 1949 committed suicide.
Oh, that explains a lot.
Maybe. I don't know. I don't think that explains, and it doesn't explain the wigs.
I think it explains, I think it explains a lot because he probably killed him.
This is all, I think this should
all be. Phil Spector's genius is that he murdered his father and got away with it.
Everything that happens on this day, I think, is conspiracy because this is 420.
Well, very true. However, later, Phil Spector wrote a song for the Teddy Bears that was called To Know Him Is To Love Him, which was actually the caption on his father's gravestone.
Oh, wow.
Interesting.
So moving on to a less somber note, 1961, Del Shannon's Runaway hits number one on the U.S. Billboard charts.
My dad still sings this song.
I do, too, because I'm a-walking in the rain. I love Del Shannon, and I don't think he gets the credit that he deserves, and I wish that his comeback would have lasted longer because Del Shannon went too soon. He went too soon.
Yeah.
You should see.
That's a very good song.
And you should see how Jake's face lit up when he got into this.
He did.
You can tell. You like him.
And I feel the pain. I love Del Shannon. The Little Town Flirt.
Wishing you were here by me to end this misery. And I wonder. I wonder. That's great.
It's a great song, man.
Good stuff. We haven't sung this entire episode, so I felt it needed to be done.
Oh, it was bound to happen. We're like already 40 minutes in here.
I know, right? All right. So also, April 20th in 1968, Apple Music launches a new ad campaign in New Music Express called This Man Has Talent. I shared a picture of this on our Follow the Sound group.
Yep.
And nobody knows who the gentleman in the photo is?
I didn't know who it was. I'm sorry.
It is Neil Aspinall, the assistant of Brian Epstein, who was the manager of the Beatles.
Yes.
Right? After Epstein died and everyone decided to fight over who owned the Beatles started Apple Music Corp.
Yes.
Which is a really bad pun. But anyway, Neil Aspinall was the president, the first president of
Apple Music.
Of Apple Music Corp, yes. And they started this campaign to try and supposedly get new people in.
Yeah,
like
new talent.
In.
Yeah.
And there was this guy who's dressed as a one-man band, which is an outfit that they bought for the thing. Neil Aspinall dressed up in it, and it had like this caption, like, this man, he now runs this company, and he set this thing. It was all fictitious. And years later, nobody ever listened to anything that got sent in, and I don't think anyone got signed off of this campaign. They just collected a bunch of, like, you know, homemade recordings.
Yes, yes. That would have been interesting to go through just to see what you actually found.
Mm-hmm.
Because there had to have been some gems in there.
Yeah, it'd be crazy to just be, you know, sifting through and be like, wait a minute. Like,
you found some guy that this is what he felt his one chance to make it big. And he just had, like, the most incredible rock voice of all time. It's like, and it's him just singing into a tape recorder. But nobody ever discovered him.
He's just some guy from Suffolk, you know.
Yeah. Nobody ever found him. And he just went on, became a plumber.
But you'll
had
still
three
hear
kids. And is 3.5. Retired.
I know. Right. I wonder how often that happens, too, where it's like, hey, you know, send us your stuff. You can make it big. And then, like, nothing happens.
Yeah.
Nothing.
I often think that some of those things are, like, flat-out ripping people off. Because, you know, they try to do it to, like, get new ideas for songs and stuff. And so they'll take people's music.
Even, like, when they do the big Battle of the Band contest, like, on the internet.
Yeah.
You know, where one of the websites will be like, oh, put up your best track and people will vote. And, you know, you go through it and go through it and go through it. You know who wins? The person, like, the band who has, like, 100,000 fans, you know, not even fans, but friends.
Yeah, it's never going to be the best band. It's just whoever can market themselves the best.
Oh, so. Yeah, they got the most votes, and so they get to play, like, the little tiny side stage at Warped Tour. Hey. Yeah.
But anyway,
what else you got?
Let's go to 1976. George Harrison walks out on stage for a production of Monty Python, dressed as a lumberjack.
And says he smells flesh burning and walks. Oh, no, that was Morrissey.
No.
Never mind.
No. This was a true lumberjack. I don't know. So he participated in the choir. Nobody recognized him. They didn't make a big deal about it. And the next day, guess who was in town? It was Harry Nilsson. And he thought, hey, if George Harrison can do it, I can do it too. So he went on stage, except he wore sunglasses and people recognized him. And he walked up after the sketch was over to greet the crowd and fell off stage and broke his arm.
Oof.
And derailed his tour for a little bit. And I think they had to cancel some shows on.
That's funny. That's funny. I remember watching the concert video for a Concert for George, which was filmed at the Royal Albert Hall, and it was done like the year after he died on the the anniversary of his death. And the remaining members of Monty Python all got together and did the "I'm a Lumberjack" song, and in true to form. Besides the surviving members of Monty Python, they had one super famous person in the choir with them, and it was Tom Hanks.
Hey.
Yeah.
And they didn't say anything about it other than you're like they're zooming in on people's faces, and you're like, wait, was that Tom Hanks? Yes, it was.
I love that.
He specifically went there just to do that, and it was just like one of those things where it just sort of fell into place, but he loved it. He said it was one of the highlights of his career was being able to do something with Monty Python.
Wow.
So that's a true fan right there. So
I love
either way, besides that, though, that concert, the Concert for George, single-handedly one of the best things I've ever seen as far as like a concert for, you know, a memorial type thing, because the beginning of it, they did Indian music. And then in the second part of it, they did like his hits.
Mm-hmm.
And so Ravi Shankar was there, and his daughter was like actually the conductor for everything.
Which daughter?
Not Nora Jones. The other one who actually still does Indian music and plays sitar. And partway through, though, they're playing a song that Ravi wrote for George, and Eric Clapton gets up there. And he's got his guitar, and he starts playing along with their chord progression, whatever it is that they're doing, and it is just pure magic.
Wow.
It was this cool thing of like this mix of blues and Indian music, and like only happened at that one point. I have never found that sound anywhere else other than that one concert, and it was brilliant. So. And then the intermission in between that and the rock songs was Monty Python, of course, introduced by the great coming down of the announcer saying, you know, that this was always a big deal, but this isn't what he wanted to do with his life. He didn't want to be an announcer. He wanted to be a lumberjack. So it was a great, great day. So,
well,
either way, moving on. We got, 1980, 84-year-old George Burns, who starred in the movie Oh God with John Denver, became the oldest person to have a hit on the Billboard Hot 100 when I Wish I Was 18 Again peaked at number 49. When asked if he wished he was 18 again, Burns replied, I wish I was 80 again. Before this, his most recent charting record had been a spoken word comedy routine with his wife and partner Gracie Allen in the summer of 1933.
Wow.
George Burns, honestly one of the funniest people to ever walk this earth.
Also one of the most noted joke thieves of all time.
Yeah, but still, his delivery was just brilliant. But then again, I mean, pretty much every comedian out there steals, so there's only a few of them that don't.
Yeah, but George Burns would admit it and brag about it. I steal from everyone.
There's been a lot of comedians that have said the same thing. They're like, you know, if you say anything even remotely funny, of course I'm going to steal it, or I'm going to twist it in some way and make it my own.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, and that's exactly what it is. There are very few comedians out there that don't steal, like, any of them. And, like, Jerry Seinfeld, Brian Regan, and like Joe Rogan, those are the three.
Or maybe half
of Amy Schumer's special time on Netflix was stolen.
How can you not mention the most stolen from comedian Louis C.K.?
Oh yeah,
like I heard a story the other day about how the Dennis Leary asshole song came from a Louis C.K. bit.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Like,
at all.
He went out on stage when and he was doing a bit about like, hey, wouldn't it be great if you're an asshole?
This is why I like people like Louis C.K., sort of the anti-comedians is what I call them, where they just sort of point out absurd things. Him and Bill Burr, I think, are the absolute greatest at it. So,
yeah. Well, Bill Burr is like the funniest guy down at the docks.
Which is why he's super funny.
Oh, he's so great. He's like, if I would want to eat lunch after like unloading trucks with a forklift with that guy every day. That would be worth going to work for.
I gotta say about George Burns too, the fact that like I think some of his biggest references in the modern era too come from Dr. Dre and Eminem, because they're always cracking jokes. Like if something's old, their metaphor is always older than George Burns.
Yeah.
You know, and so like Dr. Dre, Eminem has a song, Guilty Conscience, and in it, you know, Dr. Dre is like, yo, this guy's older than George Burns, you know, and trying to convince him like, hey, you know, don't mug this guy, he's old. How old? Older than George Burns.
All right, so moving on up to 1993, I put this in here purely for my own weirdness. Aerosmith released their Get a Grip album, their 11th studio album, which became their best-selling album to date with over 20 million in sales. The album, which features hits Living on the Edge and Crazy, and featured guests Don Henley and Lenny Kravitz on a couple of songs. But I had this album, and this album like was really good, actually. And I remember listening to this thing like constantly, trying to break down the harmony parts and stuff in the songs because they were so well done. It was just ridiculous.
Living on the Edge.
Yeah. That song actually taught me a lot about how to dynamically create a song, like how to balance out a song. Like I learned from that, listening to that song over and over again. So.
Good Aerosmith.
So.
Oh, yeah.
Moving on up to 2012, Burt Wheedon, whose Play in a Day guitar guide set some of the biggest names in rock and roll onto the road of greatness, died age 91. Play in a Day, released in 1957, sold over 2 million copies and helped inspire a generation of budding musicians, including, but not limited to, Eric Clapton, Brian May, and John Lennon.
Nice.
So there you go.
Yeah.
It's like basically the Esteban of his day. You know, because Esteban always has those, you can play now. It's like, just buy my DVD series and you can play. And this
just
guy
12
did it.
Short years.
This guy did it, but his whole thing was that you could play in a day. Here's one chord. Here's another chord. Here's another chord. Here's another chord. Go start a band.
That's five chords. You're all set.
I actually once saw that. It was in a documentary about punk music, is that a band would go and play somewhere, and then like the next day, it's like 10 other bands would pop up. And basically it'd be like, here's one chord, here's another chord, here's another chord, here's another chord. Go start a band.
Mm-hmm.
Like, these are the only four chords you need to know.
That one song from Cheech and Chong.
Yes.
Where he's like, I make millions, and I only know three chords. Fools, suckers, you know.
I actually, the weird side note for me, I remember in the movie The Corsican Brothers, it starts out with them playing in Paris. Yes, I referenced this. But I just remember cracking up the entire time because they're like... playing so bad. And he's like, in America, it's like, you know, we do getting paid to play. He's like, in France, they pay us to, it's like, to go away. So I like that. I thought,
hey,
that was funny.
I'll take the pay either way.
Yeah.
I will take the money and leave. Goodbye.
Moving on to 19, born on this day, actually, and I should have done this one first. I just got them mixed up. Born on this day, 1951, actually, Luther Vandross.
Hey!
The soul singer had a bunch of hits. Never Too Much, and had stuff with Janet Jackson, The Best Things in Life for Free, worked with David Bowie and Mariah Carey and a crap ton of other folks. Dude had one of the smoothest voices in soul music ever. And I mean, I still remember his version of This House Is Not a Home, and just it brought me to tears the first time I heard it. So
that man is responsible for a lot of children out there.
That is certainly true. He died in 2005, July 1st, at the age of 54, 2 years after suffering a major stroke. So he was gone way too soon. But
man.
Happy birthday, Luther, wherever you are.
And happy birthday to 1970s own Fife Dog.
Moving on up to April 21st, Jake said he had something very special.
Ooh, I do.
For 1945, and I don't know what it is, but I'm waiting to hear what it is. Because he said he went really far into the research for this one thing.
So deep.
Yeah, Jake.
So I want to know what this is.
What did you do?
1945.
April 21st, 1945, the birth date of the label Modern Records.
Good for them.
Okay, who is Modern Records?
I have no idea.
Well, in 1945, they formed as a label, and they began producing things that they had bought a whole lot of, like, old orchestra music and just kind of released that for a few years, like the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra, Benny Goodman, Charlie Bennett, Woody Herman, which was actually started sort of a long tradition of Modern Records of picking up older, aging artists that weren't making money anymore and giving them the opportunity to continue their career.
They were kind of like the second chance label?
A little bit, yeah, because like they would take guys who were still alive from the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra and they would release the best of the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra by members of the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra.
Hmm.
And if you've ever heard recordings of Tommy Dorsey Orchestra, it's probably from Modern Records because they're actual stereo recordings as opposed to the old mono records that were put out in the 30s and the 20s. But going into like the very late 40s and the early 50s, they signed, let's see, who was it? Stan Getz and Red Calendar, who were two very influential jazz bands that began R&B. And Modern Records had some of the earliest R&B artists like the Ikettes, the Cadets. Have you ever heard of Richard Berry? He did Louie Louie and Have Love Will Travel. Guess what? Wasn't on Modern Records, but his band, The Pharaohs, were.
Wait, he did Louie Louie?
Yeah, he was the first one to do Louie Louie, and the Kingsmen did it later.
So the Kingsmen did a cover?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So yeah. I just learned something there.
Yeah, Louie Louie is apparently one of the most recorded covers of all time.
Yes.
Really?
So, yeah.
See,
it's not the most recorded cover. But it's one of the most recorded covers.
It's interesting because, like, you never really hear that song, like on the radio or anything. You never hear it, but I like it. But I always thought it was Kingsmen, so that's actually very interesting. Thanks for teaching.
Also, in the R&B world, we got Eddie Dean, Etta James, and I already mentioned the Ikettes, so Ike and Tina Turner. You know those, but here's three more names. All put out their first records on Modern Records, and you're not going to believe this: B.B. King, Little Richard, and John Lee Hooker all put out their first debut albums for Modern Records or Crown Records, which was a sister company of theirs.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Huh.
So there you go. And then later they kind of turned into a little bit of like a country album like label. And they had a guy named Tex Carmen, which means nothing to you, but I I heard a lot of it. And then they kind of fizzled off, and in the late 60s, they kind of became that last chance album again. Like, they signed Little Richard back, and that's kind of how he was able to sort of carry his career on before the golden oldies were a format for radio stations, you know? And there you go. By 1970s, they were bankrupt, and their catalog was sold off, and then their stuff got re-released later in the 80s with the golden oldies format.
Wow.
So, but the most interesting bands that I saw that put out, because I went through the whole list of everything, is the Drink Along Sing Along Game Gang in 1961 released the album named Naughty Sing Along Party. I could not find any of this music anywhere or lyrics, sheet music, nothing, but I want to hear it. So if anyone out there has clips, please send them to Follow the Sound. And also, and I know you love these guys, Greg, Larry Cadwell with Speedy Pierce and the Saddle Tramps.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Country Gentlemen, huge album, 1962.
That's like my favorite. I have it framed.
Of course you do.
Yeah.
There you go.
What was he saying?
I have no idea.
You get a line, and I'll get a pole.
Did he say you get a line,
and I'll get a pole?
Like we're going fishing?
Yeah, down to the fishing hole.
Oh. Mm.
You know what? I believe that song is like public record, so we could probably play that whole thing.
Yeah, well, it was only 2 minutes long anyway.
There you go. And then, the last bastion where Modern Records was trying to make money was they had this thing where they would take orchestra music and have them try and play something popular to try and get old people to listen to new music,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of an admirable thing to do. But when you have like the Ted Nash Orchestra playing the theme song to Peter Gunn, there's no reason that should have made money. So
that's actually, I would listen to that. I think that'd be cool. Well, I love when you get even the more contemporary stuff, you know, like when they put out like, oh, Green Day's greatest hits performed by like some, you know, symphonic orchestra. And I would at least listen to it once just for the novelty of it.
But there you go. Modern Records has a very big footprint in rock and roll history.
There you go.
Who would have known?
Let's jump to 1976. I thought this was very interesting. The Women Against Violence Against Women called for a boycott of all Warner Communications albums because of the promotional campaign for the Rolling Stones' new album, Black and Blue. The album was being promoted with a controversial advertising campaign that depicted the model of Anita Russell bruised and bound under the phrase, "I'm black and blue from the Rolling Stones and I love it."
Mm. Yeah.
So my first thought of this entire thing when I read this, Smell the Glove by Spinal Tap.
Oh.
You put a greased, naked woman on all fours with a dog collar. I can't do Fran Drescher.
That was pretty good either way.
Yeah.
No, no one's saying she should smell it, although she should, but.
Oh, man.
Say no to sexism.
You know what's great? Knowing that this is Spinal Tap was all improv, she came up with that album cover. Like that did, I don't think that existed before that scene was filmed.
She came up with the album cover, and then her character was the one who was like, "This is terrible."
No, like, okay, so they were improvising the scene,
yeah.
And she's standing there talking about how terrible the album cover was. So Fran Drescher's like, "What's the worst thing I could put on an album cover?" Came up with a greased naked woman with a dog collar and a glove getting pushed in. Because she did know that the name of the album was Smell the Glove, so she had that to work with.
I see.
Right.
So she improvised that part.
I believe so.
And then they went back and actually made like the album cover based off of what she had.
I don't think they ever made an album cover because you never see it in the movie. And if you look online, I think that's other people's interpretations.
Oh, is it?
I thought I could have sworn they actually showed it.
No,
so.
I feel like I've seen it. All you ever see is the black cover. All you ever see is the black cover.
I'm looking this up.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I feel like I've seen it somewhere before, but maybe it could have been some interpretation.
I think that's a, what do they call that? Not a Munchausen effect. Mandela effect.
Mandela effect.
Where you imagine that you, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm not finding it, so.
Brian's over here Googling oiled women on all four.
Spinal Tap, Smell the Glove album cover. That is what I am looking up.
Yeah.
Yep. It's not listed there, so.
There you go.
They do have some of the other ones, like Shark Sandwich, though.
They did make Shark Sandwich, and, I can't remember any of the rest of them.
Oh, Intravenous de Milo?
Intravenous de Milo.
Hey, go watch Spinal Tap if you haven't seen it.
Let's see, Spinal Tap, Break Like the Wind.
Intravenous.
And then they did another one that looks like exactly like what a Houses of the Holy cover. So
how did we get on this subject again?
We just did.
Wasn't it?
I don't know.
It was a real
Rolling Stones.
There you go.
thank you.
Had the model who was bruised and beaten and bound. And that's so obviously they took inspiration from that when doing the movie Spinal Tap, which just cracked me up. Or, I don't know, it was life imitating art.
Sometimes truth is stranger than fiction.
Moving on up to 1990, Paul McCartney played in front of 184,000 fans in a Maracana Stadium in Rio de Janeiro, creating a new world record for the largest crowd attending a rock concert. Man, I would love to have seen that from the stage.
That would have been incredible.
Can I just say that if John was alive, he would have beaten that by now?
Nah, I doubt that, actually, because John wouldn't have been able... John wouldn't have wanted to do that.
Hmm.
Paul was always the one who was going after the bigger crowds and the pop music and stuff.
But those are...
John wanted to be artistic, and he didn't really care to
be
in the spotlight.
Yes, and everyone would have responded to it and flocked to the concert and beaten his number.
I don't think so.
The record-breaking concerts, though, are always in foreign countries because they have, like, the one big show.
Right. Well, they have soccer stadiums.
Yeah, well, that too. But, you know, it's like, oh, your favorite band is coming to Brazil and they're, you know, only doing like a couple of shows and it's in Rio. And so everybody
saying, like,
in the country goes to Rio for the one concert.
There's not a single venue in the U.S. that can fit 185,000 people.
Well, yeah.
They might be able to do it in some places, though. I mean, like, there are some places in Chicago where they might be able to do that.
We're going
to
fill out the Grand Canyon. Come on, guys.
You got to understand, it was probably like a flat field.
Yeah.
Maybe they had some stands on the sides, but it just kept going back from there. And so, I mean, 180,000 people, whoever was in the back, there was no way they ever saw anything.
Yeah.
Heck, the time lag from the music to
exactly
from the front
what I was
to back
say,
would have been insane.
Yeah, what the delay on that would be. Like, they finish the song and he's walking off stage.
It's like, if they've got a giant...
You're getting to the hook.
If they've got a giant screen or something, you know, it's like, and you can actually see him move. You see him, you know, hit the guitar, you know, play a chord, and it's like...
I'm looking up some of like these venue, you know, capacities just to kind of get a reference. But like I looked up Red Rocks.
Yeah, I've been there.
The capacity for Red Rocks is a little short of 10,000.
Yeah, it's pretty small actually for what it is.
But places like Fiddler's Green Amphitheater has 18,000. Jones Beach Theater is 15,000. Kiplich Music Center, about 25,000.
Well, but, I mean, you're looking at like, you know, Busch Stadium, though, that's like it's like 60,000 or something when said and done.
Yeah. And that's, you know, not, I mean, it's basically half of that.
Yeah.
You know, like
a third of that, two
sold out Busch Stadiums.
It would be like 120,000. So that's still 60,000 short of what he actually had for that day.
That's insane.
But Let's close out the show on kind of a sad note. We got 2016. Prince was found dead in his home at the age of 57. Police were summoned to Paisley Park Estate and found his body in a lift. The acclaimed and influential musician, of course, became a global superstar in the 80s and had massive hits in the 90s and kept going on, had made more than 30 albums in his career. And that's just the ones we know about.
And that was exactly 1 year ago.
Exactly 1 year ago this week.
Wow.
So it was still,
that was still huge
deal. Yeah.
That was huge.
I mean, they were still doing tributes to him and stuff at the Grammys this year.
And this was like right hot. This was like still when David Bowie was still fresh in everybody's minds, too.
I remember that because I just started, you know, I mean, I'd been at my other job for a couple months. And, you know, like it seemed every single week we were losing some famous musician to some crazy thing.
Oh, yeah.
And like Prince was not on anybody's list considering his age.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody knew about the drug issues and like that kind of stuff. And so but those drug issues, of course, took Michael Jackson as well. It took Prince and took a bunch of other people. Which is also kind of funny considering that Michael Jackson and Prince were both Jehovah's Witnesses. So
I think a lot of people like thought the world was ending because all these huge stars were dying and the election was coming up and there were just all these really big things and people were like, this is it. This is the apocalypse right here. This is the rapture. You know, the Lord is taking all of the great artists away from this earth and then he's just going to smite the rest of us or something.
I know we've had a couple of big losses this year too. But I mean, obviously the biggest one for any of us has got to be, Chuck Berry still, you know, of which it was amazing to see, the funeral and, it was a little saddening as well, to then see the funeral because, you know, like, you had very few actual, like major celebrities who were influenced by him show up. I mean, you had Gene Simmons, who of course spoke. You had Paul Schaefer, who was there, and then like a couple of other minor people. I know Nathaniel Rateliff showed up actually, and Nathaniel Rateliff actually recorded on one of the songs that's being released for Chuck Berry's final album.
Wow.
And so it's but. Yeah, it was incredible because I read an article about the Chess Records, the son of the founder of Chess Records, who was there, and he gave a eulogy for the funeral, and he actually complained that the people who were truly influenced by him and who used his music to then catapult themselves didn't show up. And he goes, Eric Clapton should have been there. He goes, every member of the Rolling Stones should have been there. Like, you know, all of these other artists, you know, he said specifically the British guys. He's like, I'm amazed that they didn't show up for this. He's like, it was disrespectful. And so it's crazy. But that didn't happen at all for Prince, you know, that was a much more tragic thing because he was, you know, pretty young. You know, Chuck Berry was very old and just died of natural causes. So,
man, RIP to Prince and Chuck.
Yeah, so I mean it's still pretty fresh, but I'm wondering after like his family took over the estate, because it was a well-known thing that he actually had like fully produced albums, fully produced music videos and stuff in his vault at Paisley Park, and so people are interested in seeing actually what's in that stuff. So
it's gonna be like Al Capone's fortune or something. They're gonna open it up and it's like cobwebs will fall out and there's nothing in there.
No, well, I mean,
and
like
it's gonna be Geraldo.
This is a well-known fact that this exists, that he has like full albums that he never released.
But wouldn't it be funny if like Geraldo actually showed up and was like, we're about to open Prince's
that
vault.
Would be really funny actually. Of course, you know, it's like gold plated vault and like in the basement of Paisley Park, but either way, that's all I got for this week in music history. But I don't think that I didn't really pick any birthdays other than the couple that I grabbed.
And
any of that. Jake, do you got any news?
Well, going off the right off the back of that story, there's some investigators, police over there at Paisley Park have released some information, including what was in Prince's system when he actually died. And boy, it's a laundry list of things. I think it was funny that the news story I read actually listed acetaminophen. Like, oh wow, Prince had Tylenol. Yeah. That's what got him. You know, it wasn't like the fentanyl, the diazepam, the oxycodone, or, you know, no, definitely list that acetaminophen right up front so everyone's clear on that. But I thought the weird thing was that, apparently Prince was getting prescriptions in one of his bodyguard's name. The doctor said that the reason for that was to protect his privacy and also to help him lose his license, apparently. So if you're Prince,
it was to help him get more drugs.
If you're Prince, where do you keep your oxycodone and your diazepam and your fentanyl? You keep it in vitamin C bottles in your laundry room. Interesting detail. Anyway, but in the news this week, Russia announces that it will not broadcast Eurovision after the Ukraine bans their contestant. Sticks
and
stones.
That's a pretty big deal, actually. So, I mean, Eurovision is kind of a massive thing, and so it's weird to see like some of the political controversies that go on with it, but it is what it is.
Well, it's censorship now, full blown censorship too.
Yeah,
I mean. Interesting.
Russia censorship? You're crazy.
I've never heard of that. Did you know this podcast is banned in Russia?
I'm pretty sure we are.
It might be. I mean,
probably just by default.
I mean, we're obviously promoting a homosexual agenda here, so that's why they would ban us. There's a pretty notable Russian violinist that came out and trying to, just throw his support into young teenagers who, feel like they're alone in the world because you can't actually talk about being gay in Russia.
That's true.
That is true.
Pretty severe laws.
Craziness. And so, boy, you know, good luck to y'all. But hey, here we go. Christy McVay and Lizzie Buckingham.
Christine McVay.
Then you just take the story.
Well, I don't have
it. Is this about Timothy McVay?
I mean,
no, that's what.
Yeah, so Timothy McVay has a new song out.
Christine McVay and Lindsey Buckingham
new song
have a new song out, and actually they are going on tour.
Mm-hmm.
And I am totally going to see them in Chicago. At least I hope I am. I believe my wife has already purchased tickets and stuff. So
I know you better make sure there's a good solid barricade between her and him, because otherwise she's gonna be going crazy.
No, she's pretty reserved when it comes to stuff like that. So, but she is a super fan. It's just that she's not like the screaming girl kind of super fan. But no, I actually really am looking forward to it, because I really like Christine McVay, and I have her solo album that she produced way back in the day, and it was really good. And then I have a bunch of Lindsay's solo stuff too. So I'm looking forward to seeing what they actually make together, because they're both really talented musicians in their own right.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think it'll be something really cool. I think that creatively speaking, they'll probably produce some of the best music of their lives together. So
that answers my question. I was going to say high expectations. Sounds like it.
Yeah, I'd say I've got pretty high expectations. But at the same time, I'm going into it understanding that, you know, these are two older musicians and stuff who might be producing stuff that sounds very similar to stuff that they've done
rumors
in the past.
What, too, yeah.
What if that
will never happen, and that's actually thanks to Lindsay.
What if it comes out and it sounds like Will.i.am and Fergie doing like some Black Eyed Peas?
I really
stuff.
Don't think that's going to happen, you know, considering Lindsay's whole thing.
Mazel tov.
So Lindsay
we
does like...
We are in Fleetwood Mac. It's the time of our lives, yo. Put your hands in the air if you like to party and shake your derriere.
Either way, Lindsay is actually a really creative guy, so I think that he'll come up with some quality songs.
You know, they should do that. No, honestly, he should do that. They should do that. They should bring in a guy and remix Rumors and release it as Rumors 2.
Like, boom, 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 boom.
The rumor has a boom, 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 boom,
boom, boom, boom, boom, boom. So, most of you don't know this, but whenever they had their massive success of the album Rumors, the record label basically came in and told them, hey, we want you to produce another album almost exactly like Rumors.
Yeah, yeah.
And Lindsay was like, screw that. It's like, I'm not doing any of that.
Yeah, I told
which
them
is,
that too.
Which is why they released Tusk later on. And Tusk was like a complete departure from everything in Rumors. And it just, like, completely different vein of music that they went into. So
if I was on a record label, you hear songs on the radio nowadays too. I think... is it Natasha Bedingfield? I don't. Oh gosh. Anyways,
I don't
constantly
know
putting out music that like all the singles are basically like.
Mm-hmm.
The record label told me to write a love song, so here's your gosh darn song. You know,
yeah.
That was the one you might.
No, that wasn't. That wasn't Natasha was that, Bedingfield. It was. Leo. The song was "I'm Not Gonna Write You a Love Song."
Was that Leona Lewis? No.
It's,
was that Gosh, it's funny because I know her, but then I try and talk about it on a podcast and I just blank.
It's completely gone.
I do it every time.
Totally. Sarah Bareilles.
Sarah Bareilles, that's it, yeah.
I'm not going to write you a love song because you ask for it because you need one.
Yeah. but that song was her like literally talking to the record label, mm-hmm. like, I'm not going to write you a love song because you ask for one because you need one. And then instead, that was the single, and the record label was like, this works. Thank you.
Yep. They got exactly what they wanted.
But I don't blame members of Fleetwood Mac for being like, how about you don't tell us what to do?
Well, Lindsay produces everything, so it's all him. It's all him doing everything for each album. And so he really, like, changed them from being the, like, rhythm and blues kind of band that they were, the rock group that they were, and then transitioned them into what we know as Fleetwood Mac, so... That all throughout the 70s and the 80s, like that was what he did.
I commend his integrity.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
He is a man of great integrity, especially when it comes to his music. So he doesn't compromise with anything. And it's really funny when he does his solo stuff, he'll even say, you know, like, well, it's like this song's, you know, the new single because the record label said I had to have a single. So
I will say my favorite Lindsey Buckingham reference is from Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
With what up with that?
What up with that?
And
what up with that?
At the end of every what up with that, it's, oh, Lindsey Buckingham. Oh, we ran out of time. Oh, Lindsey, I'm so sorry. Lindsey, no.
Which was great because, like, the last time they did that, they actually had Lindsey Buckingham
right,
on.
Right.
And that, yeah, that cracked me up.
Ooh, wee. What's up with that? What up with that?
Which is, it was really funny because they actually pegged, like, the way that he dressed and, like, kind of like some of his mannerisms and stuff. But the weirdest thing was, like, why in the world, why did they pick Lindsey Buckingham? It's like, of all the artists that they could possibly pick, why Lindsey Buckingham?
I think
it's the, like, but it just, it worked so well.
It was hilarious. Well, and then, of course, the joke being that out of all the guests that were on the show, Lindsey Buckingham was the biggest guest, mm-hmm. but they never got to him. They never had time for Lindsey because they were too busy messing
with
you know, the celebrity of the
and
minute.
Their songs.
But hey, the last story, Bill Nye has a show coming out on Netflix. It's called Bill Nye Saves the World. And Tyler, the creator, is doing the theme song, and the theme song is out. You can find it on YouTube, and I highly recommend it.
That's pretty cool. Tyler, that's the good. Creator, he hasn't really done much in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
I think the most recent thing from Tyler, the creator, before the Bill Nye deal, I think, was his show Loiter Squad.
Okay.
Which was on Adult Swim, I believe. But, I mean, he had a few good singles off of his previous albums. So, good for him. At least he's still working.
I dig it. It's good stuff.
I dig it, too.
It's a good point to end on,
I think.
I'm looking forward to seeing what Bill Nye comes up with as far as a new show goes, so that'll be interesting.
I think
a lot
great.
Of revivals coming on right now. It's kind of interesting. Somebody posted a picture of, like, a movie screen or a movie marquee, and it was, like, Beauty and the Beast, the Power Rangers, and I forgot what the other one was, but it was like, what year is it?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just another continuation of that. MST3K gets another season with new people, and now Bill Nye is getting another science show.
Yeah.
It's like,
Mystery
what in the world
Science
is
Theater
going
3000,
on?
So, yes.
I've been watching a couple of the episodes so far, and it's rather hilarious. But that is neither here nor there, and that is not music, although there is actually some great music in there. And the new host, Jonah, is like a drummer. And so he actually plays drums in the first episode, and he's pretty good. So.
And them cheesy movies.
Yes. But either way, this has been Follow the Sound. This week in music history, I had a blast doing this one. And of course, we always went over because I said, I was like, I'm going to shoot for an hour. And I totally didn't hit that mark, but it's neither here nor there. But I hope that you enjoyed listening to this episode. If you want to help us out, you can always go to our website, followthesoundpodcast.com, and click on that Amazon banner. Do all of your normal shopping, and we get a little bit of money. Or you can go and find our show on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, Google Play, any other place that generally podcasts are disseminated. And you can subscribe to our show, and that helps us out because then you give us an automatic download whenever we post new content. And we try to post content at least twice a week, if not more. And it's just a good way for you to stay connected with the show if you enjoy what we are doing. But I am your host, Brian Kroc. Along with me has been Jacob Crum.
I love you, Del Shannon. I love you!
And he clipped the mic doing that. Greg Harvey.
Sayonara.
And remember, if you hear it, sometimes you have to scream it out loud, but follow the sound.
Follow the sound!
This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.